Okay, we're back for episode 116. Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. Ready to go.
Good. Okay, well, tonight we agreed to talk about racism. Does it exist? How does it exist? And is it a psychological warfare weapon being used? So racism. Well, racism, I guess, according to the Wikipedia, all things Wikipedia, racism is the belief in the superiority of one race over another. It may also include prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against other people because they're different. They're a different race or ethnicity, or the belief that members of different races or ethnicities should be treated differently. Modern variants of racism are often based on social perceptions of biological differences between peoples. These views can take the form of social actions, practices, or beliefs, or political systems in which different races are ranked as inherently superior or inferior to each other based on presumed shared inheritable traits, abilities, or qualities. In terms of political systems that support expression of prejudice or aversion in discriminatory practices or laws, racist ideology may include associated social aspects such as nativism, xenophobia, otherness, segregation, hierarchical ranking, and supremacism. According to a United Nations Convention on Racial Discrimination, there are no distinctions between terms racial and ethnic discrimination. The UN Convention further concludes that superiority based on racial differentiation is scientifically false, morally condemnable, socially unjust, and dangerous. It also declared that there is no justification for racial discrimination anywhere in theory or in practice. That's rather broad, so I don't know what... Historically, racism was a major driving force behind the Atlantic slave trade. It was also a major force behind racial segregation, especially in the United States in the 19th century and early 20th centuries, and South Africa under apartheid. 19th century racism in Western culture is particularly well documented. I wonder why. And constitutes a reference point in studies and discourse about racism. Gee, I wonder why they focus on the West. Racism has played a role in genocide such as the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide. That's the small H Holocaust. But the colonial projects like European colonization of the Americas, Africa, and Asia, indigenous peoples have been and are often subject to racist attitudes. It's interesting that, you know, again, they focus on European colonization or imperialism or racism as practiced by people of the West, Europeans. Apparently it's not practiced by other non-Western cultures, at least as identified as such. So that's kind of racism. Now, we all know it's an accusation too, because it's not just that fact that it may or does exist. There's also now in the 21st century, it is often an accusation, like anti-Semitism, used to sort of marginalize or, I guess, delegitimize an individual or a group or people in order to shut down a political debate. You know, you're a racist, you know, or just acknowledging ethnic differences, or maybe there should be ethnic differences that should be respected either by in communities or certain boundaries, ethnic neighborhoods, perhaps culture, even cultural expressions and, you know, traditions. These things need an ethnicity to back it up. And if each ethnicity or community is subject to, endless integration, that community will go away and you'll lose those ethnic or cultural traits. But anyway, racism, Joe, what's your take on racism?
God. Well, it's a broad subject, vast, you know, because so much of human activity can fall within the parameters of what can be called racism. And for example, the construction of an ethnicity, the original construction of the Franks or, you know, the Anglos or something. You know, I mean, it's, there has to be some aspect of exclusion of another ethnicity in order for, you know, an ethnicity to come into existence, right? Or you have to have geographical isolation. But so ethnicities have kind of a built-in requirement of some way of sequestering themselves against other ethnicities, right? It's just completely axiomatic. And so I would say that that then is, reflected and sometimes in ways which are inappropriate in what can be called ethnic communities. I mean, let's look at like 1950, you know, inner city United States, where you've got Poles and Irish and Italians and, the Latinos and blacks, you know, they're living basically in segregated areas. And so there is tension. I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but I don't think that there was tension to the extent there was like warfare. There was actually a kind of a understanding about, you know, where your area was. So there was, you know, an ethnic structure that these groups grew up within. And
well, they're the Jets versus the Sharks, right?
They have the Jets and the Sharks, which of course, in the kind of is a, you know, an alchemical play, you know, the, that idea of like getting people to see this ethnic struggle and the tension and things. The fact is that you can also list many positive things about ethnicity, particularly in terms of protecting the individuals inside it. So when you transition from an ethnic structure to the vast white middle class, say, where their ethnicity is gone and you have whiteness, but that's, you know, not exactly what I would call an ethnic state. But you've lost something, right? You've lost this ability to defend yourself because, you know, like Poles and Irish, they would communicate what kind of things are happening, which are they can take advantage of, how they can watch out for the neighborhoods for intruders, things like this. And of course, there's this sense of pride in yourself, which is actually a very positive thing, right? That, you know, you're a Pole, you're an Italian, you know, you have this idea of belonging to something, and it works well inside your mind. But this all gets taken apart, and then suddenly what was sort of a beneficial or had something, you know, an aspect of human experience that had a lot of beneficial parts to it becomes something that's basically completely negative and becomes racism. And I think that racism, which is basically a kind of a pejorative for ethnic pride, really gets going with the insane pseudo psychological authoritarian personality, which
it is a concept developed by the culture of critique, isn't it?
It certainly is. So the culture of critique is this idea that cultural Marxists, you know, brought forward that they would attack what basically, I mean, just flat out was Christian culture by looking at every single aspect of it and then just criticizing everything about it. And they would particularly like to find things which were contradictory. In other words, if you, you know, praise equality, then you certainly can't have women not having, you know, the same number of women working, you know, at high-level jobs, right? Because the principle of equality. So the culture of critique never has any nuance. It always just takes, an aspect, compares it against some other part of the culture, and then attacks it. Just say it's bad. This is bad. It doesn't look at any nuance. It just takes this idea that you're bad, and then the principle, right, is then presented as why you're bad. And so with ethnic pride, they would say, well, you know, you're discriminating against other races. And they, you know, so in the destruction of ethnic pride, particularly in the Europeans, you didn't really have a lot of to and fro where you'd get long discussions about, what are the good things? What are we giving up? And what are the political motivations of the people who are trying to bring an ending to this? And this is, I think, really the critical thing, right? Is that, as we have seen so many times, Tim, things can be weaponized, you know? And if you, and people should really do that, you know, the authoritarian personality, which is just nuts, and it's very dull, you know, to read it. It's this, you know, stuff. It should be absorbed. People should, because this is really the start of so much of what then becomes basically political correctness and the intimidation, which is in our world now, that keeps people from being able to think clearly, and they can't even talk honestly because of the, you know, the power of the intimidation. But if you read the beginning of this, I mean, just reading, you know, like, you know, the construction of the E scale. The E scale, so the third term personality had all these scales. The S scale was fascism, and, you know, there was like the anti-Semitism scale, but the E scale was whether or not you were guilty of neurotic ethnocentrism. And you can see going through the, you know, the this stuff is just, you know, you have this, like, the construction of the E scale, major subdivisions, total ethnocentric scale, statistical analysis of the scale, intercorrelations among the subscales, you know, the inclusion of anti-Semitism within general ethnocentrism, the third form of the scale. And so it's just this, you know, it's a way of, like, giving numbers to personality attributes. And I guarantee you, the European is guilty, just 100%. You can't be like and have, you know, some kind of awareness of your ethnicity and wanting to, for example, associate with people from that background, because you're just going to be guilty of failing to pass the scale. And then this leads, you know, of course, to the construction of, or, you know, the way it's set up, that by Adorno and, you know, Levinson, you get this construction of the fascism scale, which when you fail the E scale, you go right into here, and then you're on your way to basically
How do the Jews rank in that E scale?
There is no such thing. I mean, the the way it's set up, there is no way that the Jew can ever, in this form, in the way the authoritarian personality is the only thing that can be studied is anti-Semitism. Okay. So there's a kind of racism that's implicit inside of the construction of the authoritarian personality. But, you know, and in fact, I would say just a normal kind of on the street Jewish guy or gal would look at this and see it as for what it was, particularly back in the 1950s. Yeah. They would have gone, this is crazy. But now you have to remember that it's been, you know, it is fused with the propaganda reality that the media has given us. And what really the aspect of it wasn't so much anti-Semitism, though that is obviously today like the most powerful, but it was black racism by whites toward blacks. Mm-hmm. That really is what, you know, basically had all of the people, you know, if you look at the, you know, these groups and these individuals, these psychologists, Horkheimer and things, I mean, every one of them, I mean, remember, it's called a study in prejudice. And that's the authoritarian personality or the study in prejudice. So just by having prejudice, which is, you know, not necessarily something that is evil, right, can also be good. But just by arranging this in such a way, this adds to the kind of sense of there being some sort of, you know, science that you have to be intimidated by if you want to have sort of any kind of ethnic pride. And I would go so far, Tim, as to say that the people who put this thing together are not particularly serious and are kind of laughing. And in fact, really what this is, it's part of the, what they conclude, they go, you know, a lot of psychologists are going to have to get together and get Eros going, you know, as propaganda. Well, this is just part of it. That's what the authoritarian personality is. It breaks apart the stuff that would resist basically Eros, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture that they want to take everyone into, because that's an easy step to get people to take when, you know, once certain criteria have been established. And from there, you got the slave state just down the road. So, you know, so racism, you know, it is the most powerful, you know, because of the two components, both the black and the anti-Semitism, it is the most powerful intellectual structure in the Western world, for sure. I mean, it dominates. It is always there in conversations. You know, if you watch like a tennis match, it is in the announcers, you know, the way that they have to kind of maneuver if one player is black, mm-hmm. or, you know, it is always present. It is something that they have been able to create this subconscious hypersensitivity regarding. And so, you know, the idea of like someone saying something that could be seen as anti-Semitism or anti-black is just there's this automatic, they're constructing a mind, you know, this European mind, where the hypersensitivity just prevents just sort of clear-minded thinking. Like, for example, you know, people are, you know, like in the public school system, where white parents don't want their kids to go to schools that are mainly black. Mm-hmm. Okay, they don't. So is this racism? Well, I mean, in a certain sense, of course. But in another sense, it's just clear-minded thinking, because these groups have been attacked. We've gone over this so many times that yeah. Particularly the American group has higher levels of violence, right? Lower levels of education. They're just as they have been attacked and wiped out by the secret society, they've become something that you can't really, in good conscience, let your kid just enter into, you know, like schools.
That, yeah, they're a lumpen proletariat. Yeah.
Yeah. They're lumpen proletariat. And so, anyway, and so.
And by the way, the same white parents won't have a problem with, let's say, having their white students with Asian students. So it's hard to, it's not. Not so much a reflection of their whiteness, you know.
No, you know,
it's a reaction to a real problem in another group, an experience they have, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the thing is that you have this just, and again, it's this hypersensitivity. I'm just characterizing this mental construction of the fear of being called a racist as being hypersensitivity. I'm just using the expression, but it's a, you know, it's a very sturdy psychological construction.
Yeah, it only seems to afflict white people.
It is only. It's designed only for. It's just like. I mean, it is literally caused.
It's not a general principle. It's a psychological warfare weapon.
Well, it's like the authoritarian personality. Yeah. I mean, authoritarian personality would not determine, for example, if you were a Zionist. And, you know, agreed with the letters that were exchanged by the founders of Israel in like the 1890s through, you know, the founding of the state. Well, and then beyond, about the nature of the need for a Jewish state, and the nature, the character that they would refer to the Muslims and just, you know, flat out call them Negroes, you know, and of no value, you know. And then describe the fact that they were going to drive them out using violence, and that there was no moral issue. Now, this is racism. I mean, this would be, you know, an ethnic warfare type thing. But the authoritarian personality, it doesn't pick this up. There's no scale here. This thing is like, you know, kind of artfully crafted to simply help psychologists make Europeans feel guilty about themselves, mm-hmm. right? That's really what it is. And so you end up with that hypersensitivity where if you go, you know, the kids who come from the black neighborhoods have a much higher level of crime and violence, and that really bothers me. And beyond that, you know, gosh darn it, I just want through Freedom Association to hang out with the people that I've grown up with who are typically my ethnicity. And I hope the black people have the same kind of feelings. And there's lots of ways we can, you know, connect and interact. But in terms of schooling of my kids, this is just what I think is right.
Yeah. And if that is indeed racism, and you may call that as a form of racism or ethnocentrism, is so what? I mean, it's why is that considered a priori somehow morally, you know, degenerate or suspect? And it's considered inherently morally superior to promote, you know, forced integration or mixing, particularly, you know, white European people, white or European background with non-European background. Why is that considered the, you know, the morally superior position? It's a presumption that's made in that argument.
Well, it's a psychological weapon. It's because why is because the people who are designing the culture, the people who are creating the authoritarian personality, they know perfectly well why. They know that the integrated culture is basically going to be an easy to control slave state. It's just absolutely. I mean, if you look at like Woodstock and acid tests and all of the ways that they degenerate culture, because it isn't just, remember, you really can see where we're going, not within the single aspect. It isn't just like, well, let's study racism and then that will give us a clue. It's the overall context. And the overall context is that all of these things are taking us in a very clear direction, right? Where there is no ethnicity, where there is no gender, where there is no intellect, you know? And so that cluster of individuals will be the brave new world, you know, and that's going to be, you know, the Delta and Epsilon class, and the controllers, whoever they are, will be, you know, of a different, you know, kind of structure, different perspective, and everyone will be happy with where they are because the drugs and the conditioning will just tell you to be happy. So this is the hard thing is kind of, you know, you look at like the authoritarian personality and then look at, for example, like all the anthropology and all of, you know, the classes that were given in the 60s and 70s, which had as this idea of that racism was, you know, this horrible problem. And then morphed into, you know, now the Brave New World stuff where you get, you know, you can't say no to transgenderism, you know.
Yeah, that didn't stem from like Boaz and everything was, you know, race, social construct.
Yeah. So that's right. That's just the other way of another side of looking at it. But that's another way to just.
Well, I don't know if you come to me and you look at the Parthenon or a cathedral and say, well, that's just a construction. Doesn't mean you can tear it down. I mean, civilization is a construct, but it doesn't mean it has some root in nature and reality. But I'm saying it's a, well, yeah, okay, but why does it mean you can deconstruct it then?
Well, you see, the thing is that these arguments aren't these attempts at science are not serious.
Yeah. It's not good faith. Yeah.
They know perfectly well this is ludicrous. This is just being done as mind control. The idea is that you present it like the authoritarian personality, and there is no critique which critiques European culture, but there is no critique of the authoritarian personality.
Yeah.
You see, there's no to and fro. You can't respond to it because all responses will end up in the F scale, and you've been accused of being a fascist.
Well, the default position is white guilt, right? And so in that case, prejudice or racism only goes in one direction, at least the accusation. Because you know, whenever you talk about reverse racism, whether it's affirmative action or these thing hiring practices, or just what's being stressed in the media, commercials, the attack on white males, and the argument will be that, well, brown people, non-white people, can't practice racism, at least on a structural level, because they have no power, so therefore it doesn't exist. And you know, then you also follow that whenever you listen to critiques or interpretations of, say, European colonialism, imperialism, it's all done from the standpoint of criticizing, you know, the European imperial powers for being cruel and harsh and practicing discrimination and violating the rights and plundering non-whites in Africa and Asia and Latin America and these things. But they never really talk about how the reality is really, from a broader historical perspective, imperialism, colonialism is a universal. But the criticism is only directed at Western Europe.
I would even add that, you know, the fact is that, you know, so-called European colonialism was racism in itself. I mean, look, it wasn't like the Europeans got together and took a vote and said, look, let's go exploit Africa. You're talking about like the East Trading Company. You're talking about
Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about very narrow Freemasonic organizations working with Jewish banking groups to a large extent. And these people had the moral perspective of just the people were like animals, right? I mean, it's just, if you look at the behavior of the, well, I mean, just look at the opium wars. I mean, you want clarity. I mean, there it is. I mean, they would slaughter everybody, you know, to gain power. The British control over India, you know, was very violent. The slaughter of, you know, the Africans in order to gain the minerals. But this problem of like trying to not just see whiteness, but try to see, well, what group is actually doing this? Because, and I'm not saying that Europeans in general are sacrosanct, you know, you know, I'm sure you had a lot of very legitimate exploitive groups, but the real bloodbath of the, you know, from the 16th through the beginning of the 20th century, the colonial bloodbath, this is a tiny organization. It's very small. And it is what's running slavery. It's what's, you know, selling opium. It is what's wiping out indigenous populations everywhere. And, you know, Palmerston's destruction of the Coolie rebellions is just an absolutely clear cut. You know, there is your truth. But then on the other side, look at Palmerston's treatment of the Irish.
Yes.
Right. So he'd slaughter them, too. So what is it about Palmerston, of course, who is the Grand Master Freemason of the Orient? What is it about this guy that he would wipe out the Chinese, wipe out the Irish, but then say now is the time for the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948? Yeah. So what's happening there? You see, if you don't look into this phenomena and try to like draw some conclusions about, well, you know, how is history getting constructed, you're not going to be able to have a very good idea about, well, what is the history of so-called racism? You can't just pin it. And you see, it's not, I'm not trying to avoid, say, just European Christian culture from being called to task in this regard. I'm just saying, if you want to know the power that is actually animating the world now and has for the last couple hundred years, you've got to look beyond that. You have to look into this Freemasonic project and see who these people are and then try to determine, you know, well, what can we do to stop it if we feel it's inappropriate? You know,
yeah, wrong. But the question is, why does Judeo-Masonry seem to target white Christian civilization more than others? Well, perhaps they perceive greater resistance from it?
No, it's because they are the sworn enemy of it. I mean, in my opinion, if you got into the Masonic oath taking, went up the thing and got into the high levels, what you'd find is just, you know, it has always been basically something which has as its goal the destruction of Christianity.
Yeah.
Because that's where the struggle really emanates from. The in my opinion, the Knights Templar are just the descendants of the...
But it's the same reason why the same forces that are always talking about racism, promoting racism, also promote feminism and gay rights, because these movements are targeting the foundation of Western civilization, Western Christian civilization. Good example is that the New York Times editor Sarah Jeong, on the editorial board, and she was, I guess, sending out some, you know, anti-white tweets. Dumbass effing white people should be canceled. Now, what historical grievance does she have? I mean, heard it has this bitterness towards what she calls white people, yet the New York Times hires her and then backs her up. And if they had an associate editor, assistant editor, sending, you know, tweets about getting rid of black people or stupid Jews, I don't think he or she would last very long.
But... they'd be arrested. I mean, I'm scared. They would actually bring legal hate crime against that stuff. But you got to remember, like, New York Times, it's a good... I mean, look at the history of it. Look at Belmont and Jerome, right? August Belmont is the Rothschild agent in North America. Mm-hmm. Jerome is he has this arranged marriage with Jenny to Randolph, who's Winston Churchill's father. And Winston Churchill's father is working for the Rothschilds as their gold, controller in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So you can see that, the New York Times as an objective, perspective. Well, wait a second. It goes right into this Judaic Masonic world 100%, even from the very beginning. So when they hire this woman and the tweet comes out, I actually think that stuff is basically, it's just is deliberately released. I mean, I think that they somehow, are able to control it and promote it because they want those ideas out. These are like the last, when you can talk like that in public without consequence, then this is really taking that I remember I called that remember I was talking about that hypersensitivity, that construction in the minds of white people. Mm-hmm. About kind of a inferior position in the world and, an inability to talk honestly about, how the conditions of their race. Well, when you get a tweet like that, then that just basically just shows you've got to be frightened and you've got to keep your mouth shut and you just have to be very careful because this is what hip, smart people in the New York Times they're able to even talk about white people in that regard. So you see what I mean? It just kind of helps everybody get to where in the point of history that they're trying to establish, where the mind of the European basically is shattered, right? And so he's ready for the brave new world.
Yeah, and he can't have any ethnic consciousness, and with that he has no agency to fight back, and
right.
And so they promote this idea of constant integration and mixing. It's funny because again there's a sort of language of inevitability with this, where it's just assumed this is what's happening. You can't stop these trends; it's just going to happen. And the Hart-Celler Act wasn't an act of nature; it wasn't. It was a law that was passed. People had to, consciously pass this thing. And so, and laws before it were meant to restrict, maintain demographic stability. And this was passed, I think, with the intention of actually creating demographic instability or change in the country to bring about, sort of cultural and political change. But no, it's assumed that other countries like Japan, they maintain demographic stability, and everyone assumes if you're from Japan, you look a certain way. You have certain ethnic traits. Same thing should apply to Europeans. America is a different story because of what it is. It's sort of a nation of European immigrants, but nevertheless, it is a construct of European, or at least a artifact of European civilization, and it was at least set up as sort of a that was the understanding. In fact, I think the first immigration law said that, all newcomers to the country had to be basically European white. That was the Immigration Act. Yeah,
right.
So there was sort of a default ethnostate, but it was just understood as that. They wouldn't even entertain the argument that people were forced to mix with other groups. But again, what they're doing is they're taking the language, with the idea of racism itself, initially, at least in the West United States, it's basically you're accused of it if you're practicing some sort of prejudice or racial discrimination against Black Americans. But then that standard was applied to other groups, and whether it's women, feminism, then homosexuals. And with this, you could break down, destroy the pillars of civilization, because you could destroy male-female relationships in the family. You can destroy public morality, attitudes towards sex and these things. Again, we're getting back to the authoritarian personality here. And all this always had strong Jewish backing. And of course, the irony is that we've talked about is, the slave trade, at least the international slave trade, was dominated by Jews. Yet they never have to apologize for it, because when they want to, they can identify as Jews, and they can identify as whites to blend in. They have it both ways. At the same time, they do claim a certain special status. That's with the State of Israel, meaning that Jews can live in various countries all around the world and still claim citizenship with Israel, and identify with that. But then again, if they are a special case, then those host countries could entertain the idea of having special policies to deal with this special case, which, you know, good example is the fact that all Jews claim, at least with the right of return, all Jews can claim right to become Israeli citizens and also go there and also become loyal to the Jewish state. It inevitably creates suspicion of dual loyalty, or at least mixed loyalty, or at least loyalty toward another state among every Jew who holds a significant position in our society or political office. And you're accused of being anti-Semitic or racist if you have that suspicion, but history vindicates those suspicions, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the suspicions that would be applied to, people who are dual citizens is just sort of would be like just routine scrutiny under any other group that had any financial or political power in the United States. I mean, look at this whole thing with Trump and Russia, and they have like a Russian background Americans, I mean, it's just the whole thing, just they're able to, to have it both ways, like you said. But then the special status with Israel, to me, is most vivid in the way they're able to treat the Palestinians. And yet the Jews in the United States are at the forefront of the attack on so-called white racism.
Yeah.
But are never taken to task to like, well, what about the Palestinians? What do you think about this? I mean, here are the actual letters. Here are the descriptions of the bloodbaths. Here are the conditions that people are living in. This genocide is ongoing, and yet you want to talk to, shout down, white parents that are trying to get their kids in a safe school. Well, it's just that the intimidation has been constructed very well. And I'm gonna just mention. Kind of this goes into some discussions I've had with listeners of our show who will send me emails. The point is that you don't really, the first step is just to understand propaganda. If you have that, if you just have the questioning of the data that comes through the media as possibly propaganda, the way the human mind is, you're almost immune to the effects of propaganda. You're very well inoculated, insulated from the effects. If you just question, you go, I don't know. Let me think about this. If you just have some mental activity as a reaction, then it's much harder for the propaganda to work. And so in terms of like our ability to rebel against the slave state, the information revolution has to just get that far. It just has to get to the point where people go, I just don't get this. I'm thinking that maybe, Fox News or CNN, I mean, maybe this is all just propaganda, right? Maybe this is, if you get to that point where you just scrutinize it, then you it's much harder to have these, they'll have, like a swastika was written on a synagogue. And, it's another example of like this, lifting of anti-Semitism that's all across the United States, you go, well, really? I mean, I'm not really seeing it here in my town. But if CNN says that, but if you're a little skeptical, then the propaganda doesn't get in, doesn't affect your mind. And then the next step is to openly question, because right now the European has that construction, that intimidation. But first, the first step is just to get them to question, to say, maybe this is propaganda. And if you recall Cass Sunstein, who government propagandist who was saying, democracy really can't, I forget the quote, but it's something like, with the alt media, it's democracy can't function. Well, he's absolutely right. The democracy is a facade, and it won't function. It won't produce the same self-destructive results if people simply question. If the level of citizenship goes up to the point where people just start questioning, going, I don't know, this doesn't seem right. I want to study this. the propaganda will stop working, and then the next step will be to talk out, to go to groups and say, instead of like, you know, you go to these school board meetings, like I've attended many, you know, here in Santa Barbara. They're just, the sense of intimidation is overwhelming. You don't really have white people talking honestly. You know, they'll use kind of a circumspect language to try to find a weird way to get their kids into gate and honor program, or, you know, they're always this kind of like, you know, kind of weak bamboozling that goes on. And it's really just, it has
I mean, like
a racial component that you can't, it's like the elephant in the room, but they can't talk about that.
Like in the 1970s, and they were doing this busing to integrate, because apparently that was the, you know, again, the a priori righteous thing to do, was to bus everyone. And if you were a working class Irish in South Boston and your child was being bused 1.5 to 2 hours, spending 3 to 4 hours on a bus to go to some school, you know, far away from his house, you know, some violent, you know, majority black school, and you didn't like that, you were a racist for voicing opposition to this, you know. And
yeah, that's where the intimidation really going there, you know, where they start just, and because the media is so aligned and part of the process by which the intimidation is created, then the white parent just stands alone, basically.
Well, look at the immigration issue. That's sort of a sort of an extension, or at least an international expression of the same, the integration thing that occurred internally in the United States, because the big push to integration, and we've talked about this, was to break up sort of the ethnic identity in these ethnic neighborhoods, to change the politics and the culture, you know, in the 50s and 60s. So you could have suburbia, you could have the 70s and the sexual revolution. And that's, of course, this is written about in the authoritarian personality, destroying the family, destroying the male, the father figure. But the same thing today, where United States, where people who are concerned about mass immigration, not just in Europe, but in the United States, you're accused of being racist just because you think that you should have something, you know, you should have prescriptive borders that actually restrict who enters your country. And, you know, I was like, wait a second, isn't this what we call sovereignty?
Right.
You know, and if your neighbor all of a sudden goes through this radical change within a few years, you know, where, you know, it was high trust, you were comfortable, all of a sudden now it's 50-60%, you know, people from south of the border, you can't communicate with them, or it's harder. You may be polite, but there's no community anymore. It's just become a bit more, you know, hostile and intimidating, and the quality of life has suffered. And you have this feeling you're called a racist because the people who come in are a different ethnicity, because they have to be a different ethnicity, because that's how they create the tension. You know, because this has been talked about, the Caligari plan in Europe, and how you, in his words, you mongrelize a society to make it a slave society by destroying its traditions and culture, its institutions that are mediating institutions that actually allow the individual to succeed or live a fulfilled life. It's only in this atomized, you know, debt-ridden, consumer-driven lifestyle, which people lack identity or meaning in their life, and so they pursue answers, and maybe in drugs or sex, you know, or, you know, I don't know, you know, tattoos or sports teams or something. This is what they want, but no one has any commonality, can get along. There's no community. If no community, there's no opposition to your oligarchic plans.
Exactly, and you know, I really think that there's, you know, going forward here, there's real opportunity for like real communion between blacks and whites, once both sides understand that they are the targets of a very destructive system. That both, you know, it's this will be tough, particularly since the black community has been so devastated. But of course, the white community is not too far behind in this regard. But both groups, I hope, that will produce leaders and intellectuals who recognize this. And then there can be some cooperation. And Tim, I have got here a theme song for this unity that I see between whites and blacks going forward. An actual song. And you know what it is?
What is it?
It's the Star Spangled Banner, the second verse. You see, instead of the crazy first verse that they always play, the people should really insist that we play the second verse, because this is what you really get to see where when they go, and where is that band, right? A band. Well, the heck, I mean, it's a group of people who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and the slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. Now, you see, Tim, the hireling are the Irish, mm-hmm. the indentured servants. Hireling is a very specific term. And, of course, we know who the slaves are. So, you see, when the Irish and blacks get together and go, you know, we are both getting screwed by the same group, they already got a song. Mm-hmm. They can just sing this. And you know what? Even Colin Kaepernick won't have to take a knee. He can proudly sing it, you know, that, you know, it's like no refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. And then, of course, the punchline is in the next one. It goes, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. Now, this is really funny, because that is actually a line from a Freemason initiation. That's mm-hmm. why it's on our dollar bill. So you get to see here that it really is the case that the hireling and the slave, even though they have us at one another's throats with the forced integration, the weaponized integration, we really do have a way of, like, hopefully transcending this maneuver that we've been the victims of. And we've already got this terrific song. You know, we have this terrific song we can just sing. And whenever we sing it, we know it can be like a little code that we have, right? That, you know, that we are the hirelings and we are the slaves, and we are sick of it. We are just absolutely sick of it. And in God is our trust, you know? How about that? You know, so maybe you have to be worried about the terror of flight and the gloom of the grave. It's not just the people that, you know, you control. So anyway, a little digression there, but I think you see my point, right? Yeah. Is that the whole race, you know, have racism and then you have the race warfare kind of thing that goes on. But this is an artificial construction. This has been deliberately brought about. In the 30s and 40s, yeah, there was, you know, tension. There were boundaries, but they weren't at each other's throats, right? You had, and the murder rates and, you know, it's trivial. Now the inner cities are basically cesspools, and this is all just a, you know, Masonic project to basically set up the slave state.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, again, you gotta, you know, when they started, you know, migrating north and into the inner cities, and the and you know, being put up in the tenement houses like in Chicago and these things, these places. They suffered an alienation. And sort of,
well, yeah, remember, yeah, they didn't migrate. I mean, they didn't need money. I can show you, I have a lot of actual historical documents about Georgia. I know a lot about the Civil War slavery. They had no money at all. They were brought. They were brought from Georgia into the North. They were deliberately, it was just like, well, how are all these, like, Muslim young men showing up in Berlin and you know.
Yeah, like Africans now are showing up.
Well, I just happen to have, like, a Virgin Air plane ticket, you know. Yeah. No, this is absurd. They're being brought for the purpose of destroying the existing culture.
Yes, there's I read an article today about Africans showing up on this southern border of the United States and making their way in the United States, then finding the ways in places like Maine, the state of Maine, and they travel 11,000 miles. That's you know, as the crow flies. But really, it's more than that, because they follow the circuitous route. And of course, one of the agencies helping this is Catholic Charities, because they're being given money by the federal government to relocate these people.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, it is a systematic destruction of culture to create the slave Brave New World.
Yeah, same way that some, you know, 80,000 Somalis ended up in Minnesota.
Yeah. And you see, the thing is that it's just like the Muslims being told to get into, you know, to go to Germany, or you know, the Georgian African Americans who were told, hey, it's great to go to Detroit.
Yeah.
We've got a train ticket and some food, and there's a place there you can stay, and there's nothing here. The jobs are gone. So you got to get going up there to make your way. Well, you know, once the people understand why they're being moved and by whom, then perhaps there can be some resistance, you know, to this. So they can, again, it's as simple as propaganda. Once you understand that it's propaganda, once you understand that the authoritarian personality is not serious, it's just there to intimidate. It's just a collection of non-sequiturs, you know, with some scientific, you know, like ribbons and stuff around it to give the idea of like there's some kind of legitimate thinking about it. Once you know it's just there to intimidate and set up a slave state, it doesn't have any effect. Nothing. You couldn't possibly get someone to who's aware of propaganda and scrutinizing it and questioning to ever, you know, think the authoritarian personality was real or something you had to pay attention to. And it's the same thing with the people who, like, I think particularly like with the Muslims who are being told to leave the Middle East, you know. But you see, they're you know, so you have the violence. They're driving them like herding cattle. You know, they're just blowing up their homes and things, and then they're saying it's one way out. You got to get into Europe.
Well, it's the same way they can do it with, like when they were integrating the urban neighborhoods, the ethnic neighborhoods in the 50s and 60s. They're just dumping, you know, you get a lot of young men dumped in these areas, you know, and there's going to be problems. And then it turns out that the federal government itself is funding some of these gangs through the Economic Opportunity Office. Or community grants, right? And you know, this is an inefficiency corruption. It's a plan because these are proxy forces that are designed to create white flight to get people in suburbia.
I remember the first time you brought up that fact, I was just shocked and astounded. I spent like a week studying it. It's just absolutely clear as a bell.
Yeah,
they were creating these street gangs, you know, funding them, fully knowing that they were going to go out and like commit violence and crime and stuff, and that this would then be used to set up suburbia.
Yeah, and deal drugs.
It was just transparent. And then so then they got the poor African Americans in the inner cities. They subtracted the white middle class was being set up in the suburbs, exit the jobs, they outsource all this and introduce the you know, drugs, which we talked about crack cocaine and, you know, like a couple weeks ago. So
Then they use like you know, the powers of public housing and social programs. They'll actually take a community and they'll declare that it's too white.
Sure.
You know, what does that mean? I mean, it's like, who are you? You know, and so they start integrating it. And this happened to Yonkers, New York, in the '80s, and of course you have Leonard Sands, a Jewish judge.
In California, if you want to do a development, you have to have low income housing, and that has to be, you know, ethnic components are everywhere.
Yeah.
So they're trying to, you know, having set up the white middle class in the suburbs, they know that now with the power of ethnicity has been completely subtracted, these people will not stand up.
They don't talk. So, in suburbia, you drive home, you know, you spend an hour commuting and you drive home and you roll up and, you know, it's like, you know, what was it? E. Michael Jones says, you pull up in your car and you roll in your garage and it closes like the Batcave and you go in and you watch TV. You don't talk to your neighbor about anything.
Yeah.
And so so if anyone does assault their community, there's no resistance to it because there's no identity because you're just white folk who.
And now that you're just white folk, you know, now they can. This isn't over. It's over when they have the deltas and epsilons.
Yeah. Oh no, it's a process. Yeah.
It's a process. Yeah. So you're heading for the deltas and epsilons, and so you're going to start. You know, they'll have a wave after wave of integrated groups, which are all designed to basically culturally debase, you know, to lower the educational standards of the community, to, because once you have to integrate cultures who have completely different perspectives, you saw this in California so often, where you have the children of first generation immigrants with like white middle class kids, Latino kids and white kids. And it was very, very difficult for the classroom to function properly because both of these kids had very different needs. These sets of kids had such different needs. But the law was they had to be in the same class.
Now, why? Why is that considered?
They were trying to injure both groups. And,
yes.
And, I've said over and over again, Ken, I saw this so clear. We tried to, at one point we tried to get a charter school going and we were having meeting after meeting with the public school teachers. Man, I will tell you, the public school teachers, there are some, you know, a few very insipid cultural Marxist type, but man, the vast majority, I just thought were absolutely heroic. I mean, they were completely sincere. They may have been way misguided.
Yeah.
Man, oh man, they were real. They were willing to, they were basically sacrificing their lives to be there, you know, trying their best. And they couldn't understand why no matter what they did, it would get worse. One of the, I mean, just to digress, they were being forced to teach whole language.
Which is, I mean, you're teaching illiteracy. That's
it's what just teaching illiteracy. It's just forced fed illiteracy. And these heroic teachers were being, and then they couldn't figure out what was going wrong. And every year things just got worse and worse. And I mean, it was just, my heart goes out to them. And I mean, any public school teacher who's listening to this, man, you know, send me a communication. We can talk. I really, you know, do certainly respect the struggle and would like to find a way to do whatever we can, you know, can to help. But the problem they had is they just didn't see the overall structure of the planned destruction. They didn't. They just couldn't believe that the whole thing, cultural Marxism, whole language, that everything had been designed by people who had the slave state in mind. That's the thing, is that once you have that little bit gets flipped in your mind and you go, this could be taking us into a slave state because we're all going to be so screwed up without ethnic pride, without ethnic strength. We're not going to have any education. We're going to be weak, physically weak because of the toxicity. Well, once you have that suspicion, propaganda is really going to be tough, I think. So we need to, this is what we got to do. We have to get that first step of getting a few million people who will come primarily through the alt media to just be suspicious. That's all you have to do. Just be suspicious. Yeah.
The process of deracination that occurred, you know, particularly here in the United States because of, one thing is just, mobility, right? People move around. And if you're moving every 3 or 4 years, you never establish a community. And that's another thing that, you know, one problem that Americans have, maybe compared to maybe some the European countries where it's less mobile. E. Michael Jones talks about the triple melting pot theory in America, where people come here and they identify as their ethnic group. And then, you know, you're a German Catholic, you're a Polish Catholic, you're an Irish Catholic. And then you may intermingle with a German. A Pole may marry a German, an Irish marry an Italian, and you're Catholic. And now that's what you identify as. And then, you know, with suburbia, you become white American. And sort of the latter stages of the triple melting, the third, the tertiary stage, this is why you see this movement now towards white identity, or at least white interest, or sort of this idea that whites need a certain agency to protect their interests, that they need to have at least considered legitimate in the political dialogue, the discourse of public discussion, that there is something as white interests. But again, what that is, that itself is a result of deracination. And it's hard to defend because once you do it in the context or language of modern political discourse, that makes you default a racist because again it only applies to white people. Although white people other ethnic identities consider legitimate, it isn't considered legitimate if you're white or you're not told that you really exist. Whiteness doesn't exist unless you're being blamed for something.
I'm just going to say, I love the euphemisms, melting pot. Let's stop using that euphemism. Let's call it, let's say, Moloch machine.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, call it what it is, right? Call it what it is, the Moloch machine. It's there to destroy children. That's what it does. Mm-hmm. It's destroy ethnicities and destroy. And, it's a melting pot in the sense of, setting something up to be eaten and consumed. It's not something that, is creating a culture that is supposed to have a lot of a power and autonomy. And this is, this is one of the hard things is you get into discussions with, cultural Marxists, when you have this kind of discussion, they basically will just try to shoot you, so it's not exactly productive. But sometimes I get into discussions on this with African Americans, and it's surprising how open they are to the idea that that the whole integrative model was in fact a Moloch machine. Mm-hmm. it was designed. There's really a lot of black intellectuals. I think it's actually maybe because their culture is in such desperate shape, but there is actually a lot of them emerging who are very suspicious of the intent of the Great Society programs. They're starting to think, and also rap music. There's a lot of them, and they listen to our show. Hi, guys. Welcome aboard. That they're starting to realize, this whole thing was set up to wreck us, and that the progress, because, they're told that, well, the 40s and 50s are like this dark ages, before the Great Society programs, before integration. That was actually a golden era when every demographic of the African American community was on the uptick, every single one. And it was a unified ethnicity that was getting stronger and stronger. It wasn't trying to integrate with anybody. It was trying to become strong and politically powerful. And that's what was taken away from them. So, it's they're the slaves and we're the hirelings. We've got our little theme song and we can sing it at the Star Spangled Banner, and every Freemason can take a knee while we do.
Okay, Jay, I think we covered it.
Yeah, I think we covered it, Tim. But anyway, that was a lot of fun, and we'll fight him again next week, brother.
Okay, enjoy your holiday weekend.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye.